You are listening to Midori House, first broadcast on the 30th of June 2016 on Monocle 24.
Hello and welcome to Midori House, coming to you live from Studio One here in London. I'm Andrew Muller on today's show.
Let us seize this chance and make this our moment to stand tall in the world. That is the agenda for the next Prime Minister of this country. But I must tell you, my friends, that person cannot be me.
Having run on a cause he didn't believe in and won a victory he didn't expect, the man who would be king decides he doesn't want the crown after all. We'll have the latest on Boris Johnson's decision to quit and the scarcely less perplexing refusal of Jeremy Corbyn to do the same thing. We'll also take a look at Australia's altogether less bewildering general election and wonder if the people best placed to reform Zimbabwe are really the people who've bankrupted it. That's all coming up on Midori House with me, Andrew Muller, on Monocle 24 right now. So welcome to another action-packed edition. My guests today are Phil Clark, reader in comparative and international politics at SOAS, and Michael Binion, foreign affairs specialist at The Times. Welcome both. Now, this time last week, as some listeners may just about recall, the United Kingdom was proverbial for its stolid, predictable politics, which erred, if they erred at all, towards the tedious. Now, with due acknowledgement that everything I'm about to say could be overtaken by events before the end of this sentence, here is where we presently are. The politician widely assumed to have contrived last week's referendum to further his own prime ministerial ambitions has abandoned them, while the leader of the opposition has emerged from the smoke surrounding his besieged bunker only long enough to shoot himself in his already riddled feet. Michael, have you ever, at home or abroad, known the like?
No. Never. Never such chaos. Never such bewilderment. Never such kind of floundering on all sides. No opposition, no ruling party. I mean, they're there, but leaderless and rudderless. And no third party, the Liberals, the little party who might be the salvation of this country if they ever got off their feet, invisible. And the clown who started it all, Nigel Farage, the man who pushed for Brexit right from the start, boasting and mouthing off in the European Parliament and making everybody feel embarrassed.
Michael, just to follow that up, we'll look first at Boris Johnson. As far as it's possible to tell, as far as it's possible to tell anything at the moment, why has he folded?
I think he's folded because he couldn't win it without Michael Gove, and Michael Gove just came to the conclusion that Boris wasn't a serious figure. Also, I think there are real differences, which are only now sharpening or focusing in his rather muddled mind, about how you can square the idea of access to the single market with not having freedom of labour, freedom of movement. And Michael Gove is adamant that they must stop open access to the British market by people coming from overseas. And Boris Johnson believes that if you do that, you won't have access to the market. And he, I think, prefers market access to freedom of movement.
Phil, to bring you in, does this now logically mean, which I realise is a qualifier which means absolutely nothing this week at all, does that mean that the next Prime Minister of the United Kingdom, such as it still is, will now be Theresa May?
It does look like it. It looks like she's played the cleverest game of
This week you're going out on a limb saying it does look like it.
this is as strong a statement as I'm willing to make at this stage. But she seems to have done that beautiful sporting thing of just hanging at the back of the pack, keeping her mouth shut, keeping her head down, hoping that everybody else would fall over.
It's like that Australian speech
the Stephen Bradbury, who won a gold medal doing exactly the same. So she's been watching sort of Australian speed skating tapes over the last couple of weeks. So I mean, she also seems to have a deer in the headlights look about her, like, oh my goodness, I didn't think it would ever come to this. I didn't think I would ever be a serious contender.
I think that is something she has in common with the entire rest of this country this week.
She's relatively untainted by the madness of the last week. I mean, Gove will, I think, struggle to extricate himself from this and all the kind of rumour and innuendo around him. There seems to be much less of that sort of problem for May to deal with. So she's certainly the bookie's favourite. As of 6 seconds ago.
And again, things may have changed while we've been on air. It's been nearly 5 minutes. Michael, we saw today Michael Heseltine, the Tory grandee, sort of metaphorically pick up the mace again and take a hefty swing with it in the vicinity of Boris Johnson's head. Absolutely damning stuff. Is Boris Johnson, both as a politician and as a public figure, now actually finished? Or can his, you know, fairly colossal self-belief actually find a way out of this absolutely extraordinary mess he's created?
Well, he's certainly finished for a while. And I think the anger of Heseltine, and particularly also Ken Clark, is that they both used to go to Brussels when Boris used to be a correspondent there, along with me. So I've worked with him for 2 years in Brussels, not on the same paper. We were rivals. But they remember how Boris used to make up the news quite shamelessly. And they remember with some venom how Boris used to distort what ministers from the major government used to come over and say to their fellow Europeans. And, of course, his writings used to severely embarrass them. So they don't have a warm, fuzzy feeling of goodwill towards Boris right from the start. And I think there's payback time for quite a lot of people now for Boris. He has annoyed a lot of people. He is a bruiser, a big, you know, fellow who just pushes his way through. Crowd pleaser, yes. Demagogue also, yes. But I think for the moment, he's pretty finished. I think he'll pick himself up. You know, he's not the sort of guy who would just slide away. He's there, he's waiting. He wrote a book about Churchill and thinks that he's a sort of Churchillian figure.
That was the very thinly veiled subtext, yes.
It was.
And of course, Churchill did come back.
He did.
Repeatedly. Churchill wasn't so much for the running away from a scrap, though.
No, he wasn't, but he was for, having a go at his own party. You know, he left the Conservatives, betrayed them, went over to the Liberals, betrayed them again, went back to the Conservatives, you know, and people forgave him in the end. But it took a war to get him back into politics. And one wonders, will it take a bust up with our friends in Europe to get Boris back?
For Australian listeners, I guess we should be invoking the spectre of Billy Hughes at this point, perhaps, although you'd need to go back a fair while. Phil, we should look at the other side of the benches, increasingly threadbare though they presently are. Why, in the wide world of sports, will Jeremy Corbyn not quit?
Yeah, it's quite startling. And as someone who's been quite favourable towards Corbyn from day one, even I'm bewildered by the fact that he's still there. I mean, he's clearly hanging on to this single thread, which is that a huge number of grassroots Labour Party members elected him to the leadership. And even though all of his MPs hate him, as we saw in their vote the other day...
Almost all, in fairness.
That's right. There's a very, very tiny remnant that seem to think that he's a feasible party leader. And Corbyn thinks that... it doesn't matter that his colleagues don't want him there. We may still have the perverse situation within the Labour Party in the next couple of months of Corbyn still being so detested by his own party, but him going back to the grassroots to get another vote from the membership and then voting him back into the leadership. So, Corbyn looks to be a ridiculous leader at the moment, but I suspect he's not going anywhere anytime soon.
Well, there's multiple ways, of course, to... infer things from the phrase not going anywhere. Michael, we are already at the preposterous position where the Scottish National Party have suggested that they should be acknowledged as the actual leaders they should actually be acknowledged as Her Majesty's loyal opposition, given that they command more MPs beneath their whip than the Labour Party presently does. That being the case, is there now a case for the overwhelming majority of the parliamentary Labour Party just to dump Corbyn, dump the Labour name, and set up shop under another banner?
Well, they could do that, but it's rather a bad precedent. But,
it doesn't happen often.
No, it doesn't happen often. When several people did try to do that about 30 years ago, it didn't really work because the Labour Party has split before, and it split when they set up the Social Democrats. David Owen, then former Foreign Secretary, decided that Labour was moving too far left, and several other prominent figures, Shirley Williams and one or two others, joined him, and they set up the Social Democrats, who didn't really get anywhere, and then they merged with the Liberals to become the Liberal Democrats, and then essentially that element of the Labour Party just disappeared, and the old party hung on and regrouped and came back. And I think, unless the entire party defects, it's going to be a very risky strategy to do that.
Okay, well, let's take a look at this story now from across the channel, because while British politics is all at once resembling a sealed knot reenactment of the closing scenes of Blazing Saddles and Reservoir Dogs, the shortly-to-be-deserted 27 remaining members of the European Union are trying to figure out how they handle this. Phil, Does the EU, do you think, by which I mean the now the 27 other member states, do they think Britain's actually going to go through with this?
I think they certainly want it, but I think they doubt that Britain's got the guts to do it. And I think all of the noises coming out of Westminster at the moment suggest that there could still be a fudge around this. I mean, I think a second referendum, which some very prominent people have been proposing in the last couple of days, won't happen. But I think some sort of classic British middling position of we'll still get access to the single market, we may have to make some concessions on things like immigration and other aspects of EU policy that we don't like, something like that is looking increasingly palatable here in the UK. But I think there are plenty of European leaders who want blood, who are fed up with Britain going across and pretending like it's special, who are absolutely furious with the result of the referendum, and may not allow that kind of middling strategy that perhaps some British leaders want at the moment.
Michael, I was struck by a quote I read just before we came on air by the French finance minister, Michel Sapin. He said that everything, including freedom of movement, was on the table. Now, what I'm wondering is, might other EU countries who are realising they have problems of their own with gathering far-right sentiment, France being far from the least of them, might they be seeing a way out here? That if we can all agree to take freedom of movement off the table, then we can keep the UK in the EU, and we can maybe shut down these cranky populist insurgencies in our own country? Or is it just that I'm way cleverer than anybody else involved here?
No, I think that's a real possibility. I mean, it is quite interesting that it's a French minister who would have said that, because France is, on the one hand, the one who is most keen to punish Britain, because they're the ones with the biggest problems in their own country. The greatest scepticism about Europe, the greatest threat that the opposition, namely Marine Le Pen, the far-right leader, that she, who has openly applauded Britain's decision, will push a lot of French people into calling for a referendum in France. And if they do that, they could well lose a referendum in the same way. So there is an institutional push by the French to really be tough and to hang in there, allied with the delightful Mr. Juncker, who has no real love for Britain ever since David Cameron tried to block him becoming the president of the European Commission. But the problem is that they do all recognise that what has triggered the no vote, or at least the leave vote in Britain, was this question of immigration. And it Indeed. Is present in all these other countries. So they do have a real interest in trying to damp down that problem. If it looks as just like a concession to Britain, that wouldn't wash at all. But I think it would be in their interest to do something about that. So I think you are being particularly clever and probably right in coming up with that scenario.
That may be the first time I've ever been accused of either of those things. Thank you. I shall be saving the MP3 of this show. Phil, we've seen Scotland and, to a slightly lesser extent, Northern Ireland suggest that maybe the EU may make to wish special allowances for them. Is that likely, or is that going to just set off another round of infighting in the EU as Spain, one imagines, demonstrates complete lack of enthusiasm for the idea of self-determining regional parts of a federated whole having their own ideas about things?
Yeah, I think so. I think there's a slightly inflated sense of importance in both Scotland and Northern Ireland at the moment.
That's
sense
Phil that... Clark speaking to our listeners in Scotland and Northern Ireland.
That's
Phil
right.
Phil Clark.
And having lived in
it's
Belfast...
Clark with no E.
Having lived in Belfast for 2 years as well, I've already got enemies over there. So, but I think there's a sense that the EU will make these concessions certainly Scotland. I think the view is very strong there, to a lesser extent in Northern Ireland. I'm trying to protect myself the next time I go back to Belfast here. But I think the question would be, what is in it for the EU? I mean, they would look at Scotland and say, aren't you more of a problem than an asset? Spain obviously will oppose any kind of secessionist type move. But Scotland at the moment doesn't bring a lot to the table. It has a tanking economy, courtesy of the drop in oil price. It has a range of other social and political problems that I don't think the EU feels it needs at the moment. So I think Scotland may be very optimistic if it thinks it's going to get special treatment here.
And just a final thought on this one, Michael. Are we yet perceiving any EU countries making it obvious that they don't think this is entirely bad news and there might be something in this for them, specifically thinking maybe France and Germany, thinking that this financial sector not far away from here might look quite nice in Paris or Frankfurt?
Well, of course, they have an obvious interest in attracting all the business that's at the moment concentrated in the City of London. Yes, I think there is some thought about that. But Germany, I think, has a more balanced and a grander idea, which is that trade with Britain is very important to Germany. And therefore, anything that harms the very robust and voluminous trade between Britain and Germany would be a bad thing. So I think Merkel in particular, that's a sort of force for pragmatism in that respect. There are one or two other places that think that this is not a bad thing for completely different reasons, and that is Eastern Europe, which itself has been pretty uneasy and resentful of what they see as the domination of the European Union by the old members, in particular France and Germany. So a little bit of shaking up of all this, they think, is no bad thing at all, particularly if it makes the rest of the EU pay more attention to its newer members.
OK, well, we're going to take a short break now. When we return, we'll be looking ahead to Australia's election this weekend. But before that, here's our editor-in-chief, Tyler Brulé, reflecting on another divisive referendum and what the UK could have, or perhaps should have, learned from it.
This is a tale of two cities with shared histories and multiple similarities, Olympic hosts, Commonwealth cousins, hubs of diversity, and cultural capital. It's also a cautionary tale of what can happen when a referendum is put before the people and, overnight, great cities fracture, public confidence collapses, friendships evaporate, and good places start to rot. I should perhaps add, this is also a very personal tale about growing up in a city that might act as a mirror where London can scrutinize its future self. The year is 1976, and the city is Montreal. Having just enjoyed playing host to the Summer Olympics, never mind that the stadium was incomplete and eye-watering debts were racked up, Montreal was a world city, home to most of Canada's blue-chip corporations, international headquarters, and the most powerful families in the country. It had sophistication, the best restaurants, the top retailers, and first-rate galleries. There were also top-ranked sports teams, an enviable public transport network, and two international airports. Montreal was the financial and commercial capital of Canada and one of the most important cities in North America. It was also a place with a fiercely independent streak in the form of a French majority in the province of Quebec, who saw their future outside of the Dominion of Canada and more closely tethered to France and even the European Union. I lived in Montreal from the early mid-70s, when Quebec's nationalist spirit was on the rise, and again in the mid-80s, post-referendum on sovereignty and another on independence. In the early 70s, Montreal felt sparky, dynamic, and international. After the introduction of some heavy-handed language laws that put French first, demonized English, and scared the hell out of local and international businesses, the mood started to shift. English Montrealers who felt they were part of something bigger called Canada were alienated by laws that favored French, and fractures that might have politely existed beneath the surface suddenly bubbled to the top, dividing people in the workplace, on the ice rink, and across the dinner table. It didn't happen overnight, but slowly Montreal started to hollow out. Lebanese families started looking at Toronto. Established Anglophone dynasties were visiting real estate agents in Vancouver. Galleries were shuttering, shops were closing, and what started as a trickle soon became a proper exodus. Quebec held a referendum in 1995 that asked its population if they wanted to be in or out. In the run-up, President Clinton appealed for reason and said Canada needed to stay united. Sound vaguely familiar? When the ballots were counted, 51% said they wanted to remain, but the damage was already done. Much of Canada was fed up with the attention and distraction heaped on Quebec, the money wasted, and the opportunities lost. From Halifax to Victoria, people felt that it had all become too raw and personal for an otherwise peaceful country. Many more felt there never should have been a referendum in the first place. If you've been wondering what might become of London and many other cities in the UK in a post-leave world, take a drive in from Dorval Airport in Montreal. You needn't drive in from the other international airport that was built for the Olympics in Montreal's boom years, because the rush never came, and Mirabel International is now mothballed, its terminal all but dismantled. That the Bank of Montreal moved its headquarters to Toronto perhaps says it all. Today, you don't see the logos of international brands atop warehouses and office buildings. Rather, sale and rental signs. Lovely streets have derelict shops and abandoned blocks. And there's a certain melancholy that hangs over the place, buffered by a slightly misguided sense of pride. Montreal is still a wonderful place. Highly livable, cheap, still culturally interesting, and edgier than moving Toronto. But it's also not a place that attracts international companies or other Canadian businesses because of out-of-step language laws and a lingering sense that much of the sentiment was personal. It's 21 years since the last referendum, and the rest of Canada has moved on. Sadly, Montreal has not. If you want to know what London might look like, take a trip to Montreal. But there's only one airport on offer. For Monocle, I'm Tyler Brûlé.
Our editor-in-chief there reflecting on Quebec's experiences with referenda. You're listening to Midori House with me, Andrew Muller. Still with me are Phil Clark and Michael Binion. Now, extraordinary as it may seem to our British listeners, there will be certain of our Australian listeners who may actually have been complaining that the election campaign in which their country is presently enmeshed has been somewhat tedious. With due acknowledgement that the unexpected seems to be having quite a good year, it is expected that the Conservative coalition led by Malcolm Turnbull will see off the Labour Party led by Bill Shorten. Tempting fate, dreadfully, Phil. Is there any reason to imagine that that's not how it's going to play out?
I think there is, actually. Oh, looking at a couple of the polls, I mean, and we're mugs for even thinking polls tell us anything reasonable these days, but the two of the latest polls this morning had this neck and neck for Saturday. So there is a very, very good chance of a hung parliament here.
Oh, good.
But I think your sort of opening statement was exactly right, that for a country that could potentially see its sixth prime minister in 9 years come Sunday morning. This has been a relatively uneventful campaign. And there seems to be a sense of lethargy in the Australian electorate, shock horror, that they've gone to the polls so many times in the last few years. People, I think, are just losing track of even who the political figures are. But in a country with compulsory voting, even lethargic people get a chance to have their say on Saturday. And I think that's part of the reason why there's a sense that this could be very tight.
I did want to ask you, Michael, as a non-Australian, about compulsory voting, which I'm heartily in favour of for all sorts of reasons. But is there an argument, do you think, that it makes it lends stability to politics, that it makes sort of weird outlying results like last Thursday's referendum less likely?
Possibly, yes. I have difficulty with compulsory voting because simply on the grounds of freedom of choice, because it is actually a choice not to vote if you wish not to vote. If you think that they're all bad, I suppose you can go to the polls and spoil your paper.
Which you can, and it is recorded. It is noted how many people spoil
their
papers.
Yes, well, I suppose that's one choice, as long as you're not punished for spoiling your papers, because that really would be limiting freedom of choice. Yes, of course, it has great advantages because it produces a result that's more representative every time. And if you only have just over half the population voting, and I think the problem in the United States is that the percentage is falling back every time, so that fewer and fewer people vote, then you really do get a distortion, and you get claims, as we've had after this referendum in Britain, that it's not a true reflection of people's will because it's less than half the population decided the vote. It's difficult to enforce compulsory voting, I would have thought. Supposing you're simply feeling ill or you're not up to it.
Get a note from your doctor or you can send someone a letter. They're usually pretty good about it. I don't know if they bother to keep count of the number of grandparents whose funerals you've claimed you've needed to attend.
Yeah.
But I don't think it's untowardly draconian as a regime. Phil, I did want to ask one weird effect on Australian politics. It surprised me anyway. That's why I wanted to ask you. Was that John Howard, our former Prime Minister, actually seemed to think he thought the UK's decision last week was a good one. And Howard, whatever else you would have thought of him, was all about, steady as she goes, stability, probity, etc., etc. Why would he have favoured the UK doing this?
I think it's explained by the fact that the Brexit campaign had openly said that Howard was partly their inspiration for the sort of anti-immigration strand of their campaign. And I think even Howard, as sort of dull and sort of lifeless as he often could be, and such a rule follower, he can't escape his own hubristic tendencies. So when people say that kind of thing across the ocean, then he's likely to respond to that. I mean, I think the one big question about this election, I mean, despite this issue that it may be a hung parliament, the big question for me is the Senate. And I think, again, we are likely to see either the Greens or some strange spectrum of independents, in fact, holding the balance of power. And we have to, I think, take stock of who these independents may be. We have good old Pauline Hanson reinvigorated One Nation Party, who makes, I think, UKIP look like a walk in the park when it comes to multiculturalism.
She is Nigel Farage without the charm.
She really is. So she's back and may hold the balance of power. Fred Nile, the kind of crazy gay bashing pastor.
Obviously,
I only found this out this morning.
This man
is still here. But my favourite, Glenn Lazarus, the rugby league champion, who could potentially hold the balance of power. It says something very dangerous about Australian politics.
Well, that's all worth looking forward to. Finally tonight, we should look at Zimbabwe, a country proverbial for its dysfunctional and chaotic politics and tottering economy, is next week hosting a conference at which Zimbabwe's ruling party, ZANU-PF, will attempt to interest the world and its wallets in the idea that it's serious about reform and it's hence deserving of bailout funds. I'm not sure that bait and switch quite landed. I was attempting to sort of insinuate that, you know, Zimbabwe was the dysfunctional country in Britain, which is where the conference... Anyway, it's been that kind of week. You can only write so many of these things. ZANU-PF, Phil, wants the world to bail Zimbabwe out at this point. Is this... I'm trying to stitch everything up now. Is this akin to Boris Johnson deciding he wants everybody else to fix?
Yeah, and the shocking reality is that Zimbabwe might actually do what Boris hasn't done and get what they want in a fashion that they want. But both the IMF and the World Bank have been making quite favourable noises towards Zimbabwe. They feel that there is the beginning of a political and economic reform program on the ground. I mean, basically, it's also the IMF and the World Bank saying we are never going to see these debts repaid. Eventually, we have to come up with some sort of different solution. And this conference in London next week may give us that solution.
Michael, is the very idea of ZANU-PF as some sort of vehicle of reform as risible as it sounds?
It's totally risible. Absolutely, totally risible. I mean, they haven't a shred of reformist instinct in them. They're at this very moment trying to close down any MDC operations in, or any MDC revival of their electoral hopes for the future, closing down publications that are supporting them. They're stamping on the opposition all the time and will still do so. And we have a bitter feud going on among the old man's cronies for the crown when he dies. And his second wife seems to be the one who is angling to get the job, supported by a number of top generals who want to feather their own nests and perpetuate the rule of the oligarchs, one can say, these very rich people, in a country that's really falling to pieces around their ears. They want to conceal the collapse of Zimbabwe with a so-called a mask of reform, backed up by international money to stop people, frankly, rising up in revolt.
Phil, is that what's going on here? Is this ZANU-PF sort of admitting to themselves and to others that, contrary to all available evidence, even Robert Mugabe can't live forever?
Yeah, that is the reality in Zimbabwe at the moment. There's a sense that even this man who's had remarkable medical treatment in Cuba and North Korea surely has to die sometime soon. And there will be a very, very messy transition period after he goes, whether that's within ZANU-PF, whether it's from various opposition forces in Zimbabwe. But I think what the international donors and the big money lenders are saying is we have tried everything else in relation to Zimbabwe. We've tried sanctions. We've tried various forms of political pressure, not least through South Africa, the large neighbour to the West. None of this has brought about any kind of change whatsoever. So maybe we need to try a more sort of soothing and sweetening approach. And that is to basically prop up this economy, to try and give some sort of lifeblood to opposition forces, to try and build a new civil society, all of which have been completely bankrupted in the last 10 years. So, I mean, I agree with Michael. I agree with what you've said, Andrew. I think there is very little genuine reformist spark, but everything else has been tried.
We will have to leave it there. Phil Clark and Michael Binion, thank you very much for joining us at Midori House. That is all for today's episode. It was produced by Ben Ryland, researched by Fernando Augusto Pacheco and Patrick Hun. Our studio manager was Toby Hammond. There's more music next. 1900 Hours, Monocle's editor Andrew Tuck is in with The Urbanist, and there's more on the day's main stories on The Daily at 2200. Midori House is back at the same time tomorrow, 1800 London time. But for now, I'm Andrew Muller. Thanks for listening. Goodbye.